here on Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Drew is out, and we'll be back for tomorrow's show. Also on tomorrow's show, very pleased to be welcoming at 6:55 tomorrow morning, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He's been making the rounds as of late, was on Fox News Sunday, and said that talking about President Biden meeting with Vladimir Putin this week, so he's looking for actions. It will be about the actions that the United States government is prepared to take to preserve and defend Americans' interests and stop motion to Russia, to Russian malign activity around the world. So we'll be talking to Mike Pompeo, who pointed out as well that when he heard the administration while at the G7 summit has raised climate change to the singular most important topic that they are going to cover, I worry that we have raised an issue that is not the thing that will make lives better for the American people most quickly and most dramatically. So we'll, again, we will get, former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's thoughts on tomorrow's show. Really looking forward to talking with him at 6:55. Right now, we are pleased to welcome to the show Second Amendment expert, Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. Calls as friend of the show as well. I reached out to him to get thoughts on this federal lawsuit. Good morning, Rob Dorr. How are you doing this morning, sir?
Oh, we're hanging in there. How about yourself?
Doing all right, buddy. I know we're a little late to the party on this. This came out about mid last week, but I wanted to get you on to go over some of the details on this. Three young Minnesotans are suing for the right to legally carry handguns in public, alleging that the state's minimum permitting age of 21 is discriminatory. The lawsuit was filed on Monday of last week in the U.S. District Court here in Minnesota. It argues that even though the U.S. citizens who are 18 years of age are considered adults for almost all purposes, the state unconstitutionally bans them from carrying handguns outside their homes or automobiles for self-defense. Why, obviously it's an important issue to be raised at any point in time, but is there any specificity as to why this is being raised right now at the moment, Rob Dorr?
Yeah, so we are co-plaintiffs on this lawsuit. Three of our members who are between the ages of 18 and 20, they're interested in carrying. They want to get a permit to carry, but Minnesota has set this arbitrary minimum age of 21 in order to exercise your right to carry. Now, as we look at kind of how things have been, it's been really about 6 years since we've passed any real good pro-gun legislation in Minnesota. And even then, it was with a divided legislature. So we haven't had a whole lot of success being able to advance pro-gun measures or kind of reclaim some of these rights that have been taken, including this arbitrary 18 to 20 restriction. So now we are looking at the courts. We're looking at the way that the courts have developed into basically just declaring the, rather than going through the legislature, just declaring these laws as facially unconstitutional.
What kind of confidence do you have at this point in time?
Well, you know, there's a strategy that's at play here. You know, some people, I think probably the biggest fallacy that a lot of gun owners fall into is, well, I'm not 18, 19, or 20, so this doesn't matter, so I don't care. And that's a wrong way to look at it. Is if we're going up a ladder of kind of reclaiming all of these rights that have been taken away from us, we need to start with the low-hanging fruit. And this one is really low-hanging fruit. We did just receive notice, too, that our case is going to be heard before a Trump-appointed judge. So, you know, we've got some level of optimism there. But there's also cases that are going along in other states. Georgia's having a case like this. Tennessee's got a case like this. California. So what we're really setting ourselves up for is having different opinions through different appellate courts, ultimately looking at the Supreme Court to decide, does the Second Amendment protect a right to bear arms, and does that apply to all adults?
It's interesting, and I like the timing of it, seeing, as you mentioned, that there were other states that were looking at this as well. It appears as if, you know, this is a striking while the iron is hot type of situation, and hoping to get some, at least at a bare minimum, some clarity on this specifically, but obviously also hoping to enact the change you guys are looking for.
Yeah, and we know as early as October of this year, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing a case out of New York that's going to determine whether the Second Amendment protects a right to bear arms outside of the home. So this one is we're kind of looking down the field. We're optimistic that we're going to get a favorable reading in that one. So we filed this lawsuit in order to kind of ask the next logical question: is okay if the Second Amendment, you know, Heller decided back in 2008 that the Second Amendment protected an individual right to bear arms in the home for self-defense. This case out of New York is going to determine whether that right extends outside of the home, and then this case will determine. Okay, does the state have the ability to set arbitrary restrictions like a minimum age of 21? So while it is talking about 18 to 21-year-olds, every gun owner should have a very specific interest in making sure that this lawsuit succeeds.
Is there any kind of timeline in terms of anticipating when you expect to begin to, you know, hear some word back from the courts, whether on this particular lawsuit here in Minnesota or the other ones you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I'm, you know, my nose has been kind of into the grindstone on this case since we're part of one of the parties that filed it.
Sure.
But we're probably looking at within the next 6 months, we'll at least have preliminary hearings in some of the states. I'm hoping ours are. The federal courts are kind of winding back up after being heavily restricted during COVID. So I don't know how strong their backlog is, but I do imagine at least before the year is out, several of these cases will have at least had their first shot in district courts.
Are there any, if you were able to get the age requirement lowered, is there anything else that can come about because of that you would be looking at, sort of unintended consequences beyond an individual being able to have their gun carry permit?
Yeah, you know, and that's a great question, because that's really what we're looking at here is what level of authority does the state have to restrict a fundamental constitutional right?
Mm.
And so the low-hanging fruit with this one is 18 to 20, because if you think about it, we have 18-year-olds who are serving in the military.
Right.
We have our members who are 18, 19, and 20 who serve in the National Guard, even though they may just be cooks. They still serve honorably in the National Guard 1 week in a month and several weeks a year. They're carrying a firearm to protect their communities, to protect their country, but yet they can't go home and protect themselves. It's just a ridiculous requirement, and it's one that we could start to kind of tip the dominoes to say, okay, the government has gone way too far in infringing upon these rights.
Well, and you brought up a better argument than I was going to make, but I'll add this one in there too. There is a sense of a double standard even beyond what you said on a lesser front, where, you know, we allow competitions for individuals who are under 21 to use, you know, firearms as well. So, and again, you raised a much better argument than the one that I did, but that's the one that I kind of defaulted to, was, well, you know, in these other circumstances, we are allowing young people the opportunity to compete, you know, with firearms as well, but yet they can't get a gun carry permit, you know, until they're 21 years old.
Yeah, you know, it's not a matter of how trained you are. You know, every permit to carry holder goes through training and a shooting qualification and extensive background check process. So that doesn't really apply. You know, they can look at it and say, well, you know, teenagers or the young people are more apt to be involved in crime. But the statistics show that the ages of 24 to 30 are far more criminal ridden than the ages of 18 to 24. So that doesn't hold weight. But then also, our lead plaintiff on this, it's a female, and females are pretty much statistically irrelevant when it comes to firearms crime. 99.9% of all firearms crime are committed by males. So, you know, when we're discussing this, we're restricting these rights. Their best argument will be because, you know, of crime rates, but that doesn't apply universally, and we're still actively denying people their rights based on statistics. If that's going to be the excuse, that's definitely not going to hold up.
Well, if you don't get your way talking with Rob Dorf from the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus about this federal lawsuit that the state can age limit for handgun carry permits being unconstitutional, maybe if you don't get what you want via the courts, since Governor Tim Walz is planning on extending his emergency powers for a 15th time, maybe you can just get him to do like an executive order. You have any?
it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because our organization was involved in restricting the governor's ability to remove firearms or prohibit the right to carry during a state of emergency. We passed that bill back in 2015. How fortuitous that was!
Wow,
never imagined we'd have a 15 months of single party rule here. But the governor, when asked by media and asked by anti-gun organizations, why did you allow gun shops to be open, or why don't you remove the right to carry because of all the civil unrest? He specifically said, "Well, I legally can't." While he may be interested in going down that route, we've pretty much been effective at prohibiting him from doing those kinds of things.
Rob Dorr, before I let you go, take off your Minnesota gun owners cap for just a moment, and I would like to get your thoughts on Walz continuing to extend his emergency powers for a 15th time today. I know that's not a huge surprise to those of us paying attention. How much of this do you think, is this all about the special session at this point in time, or is it just continuing, just Governor Tim Walz is going to hang on to this for as long as he possibly can? What do you think?
I think that there's a few lingering things that they're kicking the can down the road on. Probably the biggest one that comes to my mind is the eviction moratorium.
Yeah.
That is a storm that is brewing, and the legislature hasn't addressed that. And one of two things is going to happen. Either eventually the eviction moratorium comes and there is a storm of people who are getting evicted out of their houses because they're a year or more behind on their rent or their mortgages, and they just didn't care. Or the government is going to bail them all out, and there's going to be a huge amount of money going to keep people in their homes who have just decided to not pay their mortgages. So I think that's one of the bigger ones. There's a few other things, but I'm not as apt to say that it's because he enjoys the power, although I'm sure he doesn't hate it. but I think he's continually kicking the can down on the road. And I think it's ridiculous that we're in the state of emergency. I think when you look at Minnesota Statutes Chapter 12, it's entirely clear that this is to allow the governor prompt ability to respond to an emergency where there's just not enough time for the legislature to get into session. And the legislature's in session. They're the ones who are supposed to be setting the laws. They're the ones with the oversight, with the accountability. It's ridiculous that we're still under this single-party rule.
Well, and I thought that last week, and I could be wrong on this, I thought the Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka last week had offered an ultimatum when it came to the eviction moratorium. Like, if he relinquished his power, that they would still go and address that particular issue. Do you remember that or no?
I that has been part of the discussions, at least that Paul has said publicly. I don't know what agreements were discussed in private. So I imagine that if that hasn't happened, then they probably haven't reached an agreement on that. But that storm is the one that I think is on the horizon that I don't know. I've got friends who are landlords, and they know that their tenants have been gainfully employed throughout the entire pandemic, but just stopped paying rent because they didn't have to.
That's insane. Look, at this point in time, I expect to be 1 year later and to be talking about Walz requesting his emergency powers extended for the 30th time. So that's just kind of where my head's at. Rob Dorr for the Minnesota Gun Owners Caucus. Hey, man, thanks for the time this morning. I appreciate it, buddy.
Yeah, and I do want to say, please, if anybody wants to help contribute to this legal fund, you can make a tax-deductible donation. This is separate from our political actions. This is a nonprofit venture that you can have a tax-deductible donation on our website, gunowners.mn, on the support fund.
Thank you. Hey, everybody go and check out, gunowners.mn. Thank you, Rob. We'll talk to you again soon, buddy.
Appreciate it.
651-989-5855. All right, we'll turn our attention to Minneapolis, both north and south, as social justice battles rage in Uptown. Vehicle hits protesters, killing one. And on top of this, very high-profile salon closing down, much to the shock of a lot of people. We'll give you details on that. Plus, the editorial board of the Star Tribune put out this... weak is the only way I can describe it. Right, this weak editorial on balancing interests at George Floyd Square. Look, they say that 38th and Chicago should be reopened, but what's astonishing about this particular article is that it ignores the realities of what's actually happening on the ground. We talked about this at length on last week's show, I believe, on Thursday, this fantastic piece that Dina Winter put together in the Minnesota Reformer talking about the amount of the hundreds of thousands of dollars being given to these activist groups like Agape to go and be in charge of security. And not only that, it was also happening in Brooklyn Center as well. There is no mention of that whatsoever inside of this editorial board article about balancing the interests of George Floyd Square. We'll get into this. But again, you know, the Star Tribune is supposed to be, it's supposed to be, right? It's supposed to be like the, you know, like the shining beacon of journalism here. And it's not. It's absolutely, they're completely ignoring the reality of what's been taking place in the streets of Minneapolis. And we'll talk more about it coming up on Justice and Drew. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice and Drew, along with Sam, and the phone number is 651-989-5855 if you want to join in the conversation. I am John Justice. Drew will be back on tomorrow's show. Looking forward to having him back. He's going through a routine procedure this morning, but we'll be back with us tomorrow. A little bit later on in this hour, pre-post-pandemic unintended consequences. So again, I'm not comfortable saying that we're out of the pandemic yet, so we're almost out of the pandemic. Well, I mean, I guess we can't like officially be out of the pandemic until Governor Tim Walz goes and gives up his emergency power. So we have pre-post-pandemic unintended consequences, including airlines have seen an unprecedented rise in disruptive passengers. Experts say it could get worse. However, when you actually look at the numbers and you break it down, we're kind of par for the course. This feels like a when it comes to aggression in the, you know, at 30,000 feet. So we'll get into some of the details on this. It feels a lot like when people were focusing on shark attacks, but the shark attacks have always kind of remained consistent every single year. So we'll dive into that a little bit later on in the show. Right now, though, let's go here. The Star Tribune, focusing on Uptown in northern Minneapolis, a social justice battle is being waged in an Uptown Minneapolis alley again and again and again. So the entry lane to the parking garage where Winston Smith was killed by a law enforcement task force has been painted and repainted at least five times in the past week as activists and the property owner strive for the last word. Now, to get everybody up to speed, Smith was killed on June 3rd after police surrounded him on the top floor of the parking garage at Seven Points, the shopping mall formerly known as Calhoun Square. Authorities say he fired a gun from his vehicle as the task force tried to arrest him on a warrant from Ramsey County for being a felon in possession of a gun. Now, that whole incident is being called into question. The female that was in the car has told her attorneys, even though she's remained anonymous, that she didn't see a weapon. Now you are hearing things like, you know, this is the people's evidence. Hopefully, the BCA will come out in fairly short order to confirm that Winston Smith did have what they said that he had. If not, we're going to have a whole host of other issues. So beyond that, I'll give you sort of the update. What's happening now is the entry lane to the parking garage, right, has been repainted at least five times between activists and the property owner. Late Sunday, Minneapolis police said someone drove a vehicle into a group of protesters there at Lake Street and Girard Avenue and was taken into custody. Now, what's interesting about this is Sam had it in her top five this morning. If you missed it, be sure you listen to the 6 o'clock hour of the show podcast. And it happened around 11:40, and according to this story from the Star Tribune, the driver's motive was not known at this point. You did have in your top five that apparently there was potentially drugs and alcohol may have been involved.
Yeah, there in this story, the police did say that there were early indications that drugs or alcohol may have been involved in that crash.
So you had a bunch of people standing in, and look, and there's no justification for either side of this. You had a bunch of people standing in the middle of the street protesting.
Yep.
And then you had a car that was actually driving on a street that's normally reserved for cars, not protesting. He was pulled. He was pulled from his vehicle by protesters and was being struck before taken into custody and then being treated at the hospital. Meanwhile, as residents in the area hope for peace, a high-profile business announced on Sunday that it was pulling out of Uptown after 35 years, citing concerns about crime and social unrest. Jute Salon Spa, a fixture at the corner of Hennepin Avenue and Lake Street, posted the news on its Facebook page. It has become more and more evident that that Uptown continues to struggle with store closings, social unrest, crime, and street closures, it read. We would be heartbroken if anything were to happen to our team members or clients. With that at the forefront, we have made this difficult decision. Apparently, that particular, and I got to find the subsequent story here, but apparently that particular business has served in some capacity for like 26 years or something like this. Wow. In different iterations.
Mm-hmm.
But look, the leadership doesn't care. They don't give a rip about any of this. Right? I mean, we have the sort of the stereotype. And because there's a reality to it, right? That your Democrat, your DFL, your liberal leadership doesn't care that much about the small business owner. There is some truth to that. And that comes to the forefront when you look at a situation like what's happening now. They don't care about these businesses. They may say that they do, but their actions don't show it. And we'll talk more about 38th and Chicago and the autonomous zone. But again, as an example, if they cared about businesses, you wouldn't have an autonomous zone and a 38th in Chicago still closed down. If the leadership here in Minneapolis cared about these businesses, they would try to do something to go and curb this weekend activity from taking place. We have other means of law enforcement, and we've used those other means before. Going to continue to beat this drum. You could call up the National Guard because it's the only way you're going to be able to get a grip on any of this. Like what Agape did in trying to open up now twice 38th in Chicago. Like the mindset's right. You do it early in the morning before things get busy, before things are people are working. You establish a new back to normal of an intersection being open, but you're not going to get anywhere unless you have a police or law enforcement presence there to uphold the peace. And now you have this convergence of what's happening south of the city, 38th Chicago, Chicago and the autonomous zone. And then what you have happening in North Minneapolis and now in Uptown. And I want to add another element to this too. What does it matter to any of these people? To keep painting and repainting this exit here in this parking garage. I mean, maybe if you knew Winston Smith personally or were related to him as a family member. But like you see on the side of the roads, memorials for individuals that have died on a street. Maybe it was a pedestrian struck by an automobile or a bicycle rider. You know, even those don't stay up forever. Eventually, city crews come by and they remove those makeshift memorials and they take them down from the place where individuals went and lost loved ones. But like for the individuals that are working inside the autonomous zone in George Floyd Square that have a list of 24 demands, why should anybody give you guys anything? I mean, why do you deserve anything in the wake of the death of George Floyd and the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin? I mean, that's a part of this whole thing that never gets addressed anymore. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in this editorial from the Star Tribune because they missed that glaring point in all of this. Right? These people, I know they had their feelings hurt, and I understand that. And I understand that they may have their own legitimate concerns about what they perceive is systemic white supremacy, racism, or violence coming at the hands of law enforcement. Like, I get that. But unless they've experienced it in and of themselves, and if they have, they need to deal with it in the way that we have the mechanisms to go and deal with officers acting inappropriately. But when it comes to the death of somebody else and a narrative that may be out there, these individuals are selfish people that don't have any sort of grip on their own feelings and emotions because there's no justification for any of this right now. Now, Winston Smith's death coming on the heels of other high-profile killings of black men by police sparked several nights of protest. It also prompted activists to paint the alley red last week with the message, blood on their hands. Then Marvin Applewhite, a Minneapolis resident who leads a crew of young people removing graffiti in the city, washed off the red paint and helped others paint the alley rainbow colors. Activists then painted it red again, according to Tori Slolinger, who's been watching it all from her home in the walkway apartment building across the street. On Saturday, a crew, it's uncertain whether it was working for the city or Seven Points, painted it a light gray. And on Saturday evening, activists painted it red again with the word "Stop the Cover-Up." Oh, this is so ridiculous. What a colossal waste of time. Put your efforts towards something constructive. Painting over the rainbow during Pride Month upset some members of the gay community who took it as an insult and then went and vented about it on social media. But Slolinger, who is gay, said that's not the case. I wasn't mad about being, it wasn't about being mad at gay people, she said. They just want it red. It's important to them. Slolinger, who's in her 50s, expressed concerns about what she called the changing character of Uptown. In addition to Jute closing, another local landmark, the Uptown Theater, recently announced that it would be moving out of the iconic building it has occupied since 1939. I am worried that this is an area that is going to go into the swamps. Yes, there are too many bars, she added, saying the area needs more businesses. Applewhite said activists are striking back at the wrong people by painting on buildings and other property. Graffiti, he said, it's a form of bullying. If you're gonna paint something, paint a red floor at the U.S. Marshals building. But they're too intimidated to do that, Applewhite added, that he doesn't have a beef with anyone. Is this not par for the course for what's happening right now? Mass confusion, painting and repainting battles over social justice, all mixed in with the fact that we don't have even enough law enforcement to deal with the rising crime that we have within the Twin Cities and certainly within Minneapolis. And there is nothing on the horizon to indicate that it's going to be changing anytime soon. You know, if we had some better reporting, I do believe that we would be able to get somewhere with all this, but we don't. We have some secondary outlets, like we talked about last week with the Minnesota Reformer, that are doing the actual journalism work by going in and getting into the details of these contracts that the city of Minneapolis has put together for hundreds of thousands of dollars with these activist groups that are supposed to be keeping the peace. But you're not going to hear about that and haven't heard about that in the Star Tribune. As a matter of fact, and we'll talk about this next, balancing interests at George Floyd Square. Intersection can stand as a memorial with access restored. What cracks me up on this is they're talking about the excuse of opening up 38th Chicago again. You know what they're pointing to? They're pointing to polls. That's a part of it that just cracked me up. Well, polls in the local area say that people would like to have the intersection open again. How about just the law? Why not just look at it like that way? Right? Like, you shouldn't be blocking off four square blocks and having individuals armed being able to decide who comes and goes in an area. That's an insurrection and it's unlawful. How about you take that approach? Like, what does the law say about the actions of the individuals who continue to do those actions in the wake of the murder conviction of Derek Chauvin? But no, what does the Star Tribune do? They go, well, local polling says, even if the polling sends them in the right direction and the Star Tribune editorial board is saying they should open up 38th in Chicago, they're wrong in looking at polls as the justification and rationale for why that area should be opened. 651-989-5855. I'll give you details on this. Plus, car dealerships are now offering a catalytic converter theft deterrent. It's all coming up on Twin Cities News Talk. Floyd Square in Minneapolis is well known as a gathering place to honor the man who was murdered by a police officer and a symbol of racial healing, justice, and reconciliation. I, 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 I cannot relate. Welcome back to Justice and Drew here on Twin Cities News Talk. Drew will be back tomorrow. Look, I can't relate to that location being like that for people that didn't have any relation to George Floyd. I can't. Maybe it is for some people. I get it. I understand the need for memorials, right? And certainly for loved ones that have passed away and things like that. But I just, this symbol of racial healing, justice, and reconciliation, certainly not with 38th and Chicago and the Autonomous Zone, when, in my opinion, nothing good has come of any of that. We've had five homicides that have taken place in there. You've had freedoms and liberties trampled upon by a bunch of selfish individuals who feel like they're deserving of 24 demands, even though they weren't even related to George Floyd. I don't get any of that. Now, the Star Tribune editorial board goes on to say, visitors from all over the nation and even the world have come to bring memorials of various kinds and stand near Floyd, where Floyd lost his life just over a year ago under the knee of former officer Derek Chauvin. At the same time, the area of 38th and Chicago Avenue, now held in such reverence but also closed to traffic, has been a busy thoroughfare and provided essential access to businesses, transit, city services, and the surrounding neighborhood. Of course, they don't mention the four blocks that are blocked off and cordoned off, right? And as Mayor Jacob Frey has pointed out, access is the law, meaning the city is required to provide it for businesses and residents. So the city's been basically breaking the law for a year. That's the key reason why the intersection should reopen with some type of memorial standing in the area. Well, good. I'm glad you acknowledged that. In our view, both goals are possible despite the efforts of some community activists to permanently keep those blocks cut off from traffic as a memorial site. Twice in the last week or so, a community group, Agape, and the city have tried to respectfully clear the area for the return of traffic, only to see protesters put the makeshift barriers back up. And let's be honest here. If the city had really tried to do it, they would have brought in law enforcement. They would have reached out to Governor Tim Walz. Governor Tim Walz would have taken the opportunity for the suggestion of using state patrol or use his emergency powers for something good like calling up the National Guard, but none of that has happened. The access arguments are supported by at least two polls of those most affected. No, Star Tribune, you had it right the first time. You don't need polls and city surveys of the area from residents. It doesn't really matter. You need to look at it from the letter of the law. And right now, what's happening is unlawful. Residents are concerned about the safety as the area has been especially hard hit by rising crime rates. Many neighbors worry that the area is almost a no-go zone for law enforcement. Almost? As an example, gunshots rang out near the intersection on May 25th of this year, just as the memorial activities were about to begin on site. Wake up, Star Tribune. There's so much stuff happening in there they're just simply ignoring. Following dozens of meetings with citizens and businesses in the area, the city officials rightly concluded the intersection should be reopened. We are collectively committed to establishing a permanent memorial at the intersection, preserving the artwork and making the area an enduring space for racial healing, right? And this was according to one of the city council members. In that spirit, the city has two possible plans for reopening on its website that both call for some level of traffic. Both are reasonable possibilities that respect the need for a place of remembrance and the need for community safety and commerce. I bet they felt so good, right? They just felt so pleased with themselves over this. You know, Star Tribune, you could go a lot further in getting done what it said that you wanted to get done in this if you actually did that thing called news. Like, if you actually were, like, journalists and you went down there and you actually covered what was really happening. I'm not talking about the memorials and the remembrance. I'm talking about the drug abuse, the drug deals that go down. I'm talking about the individuals that can't get essential services to their homes, the individuals who have been injured or shot and dragged out of the autonomous zone because it is a no-go zone. The fact that law enforcement can't go anywhere near there without being accosted, even though they've done nothing wrong. If you reported all of that, maybe... maybe if you did the work that, like, the Minnesota Reformer did and got it out to people who read your trash, perhaps you'd be able to get what you wanted in that editorial. But you continue to ignore the truth of what's going on to appeal to the base individual that likes to read what it is that you put out there and doesn't put a lot of thought into the fact that you're glossing over the violence and the homicides that are taking place in that area. catalytic converter thefts have become such a problem that some car dealerships are now charging $60 for theft deterrent services. One dealership is now offering to spray catalytic converters with high-temperature flame-proof orange paint and engrave VIN numbers on the converter casing.
That'll fix it.
A sign at the dealership actually promotes catalytic converter theft deterrence. Even still, the dealership does not guarantee against catalytic converter theft, but hopes the installation of our product will encourage thieves to move on to an easier target.
What?
Catalytic converter thefts have increased from 207 in 2019. You ready? You ready?
No.
207 in 2019 to 1,474 last
what?
Year.
What?
No!
That's a 600% increase.
No!
Suburbs like Eden Prairie have said they've experienced similar increases. As of May 20th, Minneapolis had reported 642 catalytic converter thefts, an increase of 27% over last year's already record-setting numbers. Imagine, if you will. Paint, if you will, a picture. Imagine, if you will, just 642 automobiles. I mean, that's a lot of catalysts.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And officials don't care. They probably like it. They don't care. The leadership in I'm sure certain members of our law enforcement care about this. They would love to be able to do something about this, but they've got a bigger, they've got bigger criminals to catch, unfortunately. But I don't think the leadership gives a rip about this at all, or Governor Tim Walz. They probably, secretly behind closed doors, they're probably pleased as punch that people's, gas-guzzling automobiles are getting ripped off of catalytic converters. They don't care.
How entrepreneurial of those catalytic converter thieves to go out and, make some money for themselves.
I've never seen anything like this in my life. Never have I seen just a complete and utter absence of leadership. And on top of it, right, just to add one more point, and then we'll try to talk about a couple of fun things. But on top of that, you actually have a governor who has extended his emergency powers, which gives him, right, the unilateral ability to do all kinds of things. 15 times, 450 days. So he actually has the power, because it hasn't been able to be stripped from him, to do something about it right now. And when he's asked, he scoffs at the idea of bringing in state patrol. Won't consider the idea of National Guard. You could handle the problem right now today. You could call up the National Guard troops. You can send them in. You can send them into Uptown. You can send them in to 38th in Chicago. They could open it back up with the city crews. And they could keep the peace until it was established once again that this is an area where we respect the law. And he does nothing. Just, ugh. All right. Let's switch gears. Apparently, airlines have seen an unprecedented rise in disruptive passengers. Experts say it could get worse.
Why? Why are people being disruptive?
Well, they're blaming it on the mask mandates, but the numbers don't really bear this out. So the FAA told the Washington Post that they've received about 2,900 reports of unruly passengers. Right, unruly passenger behavior since January 1st. They say that roughly 2,200 of those involved passengers who would not comply with the federal mandate for wearing a face covering. The agency identified potential violations in 446 of those cases and started enforcement action in 42. And apparently the numbers have grown in recent weeks. Some observers worry the trend still hasn't peaked as prime summer travel season approaches. Now, what's interesting about this, though, is you dig further into the article, and it does say right at the end, bad passenger behavior is nothing new. The International Air Transport Association raised the alarm on the issue of unruly passengers a few years ago. The global group said that it had gotten reports of more than 66,000 incidents between 2007 and 2017. So if you go for, we'll say, 3,000 in the first 6 months, right? So for half the year, then you know, then you're looking at, you know, so 3,000, then you're looking at 6,000 for the year over a 10-year period, and you're about on par with the standard of 66,000 incidents between 2007 and 2017. And maybe the differential there is the fact that not as many people are flying. So the number is relatively high for the few people that are flying right now, and it mostly is surrounding the mask mandate. One individual, a professor of aviation management at the Metropolitan State University in Denver, Jeff Price, says, I think it could get worse as more and more mask restrictions are lifted throughout the country. The vast majority of cases reported to the FAA involve the refusal to follow the federal mask mandate, which is in place until September 13th. Oh, okay, so we actually have a date. Why do we have a date?
I have no idea.
Why do we have a date of September? Okay. Experts say...
it's so random.
Again, we're sort of doing the walls way of dealing with COVID. We're just picking arbitrary dates on a calendar. Right?
Makes no sense.
No, it doesn't. It's funny, though, because it talks about on here, pre-existing diversions in the United States aren't helping. Pre-existing divisions. Nelson said flight attendants have found that there are regional patterns to bad behavior. There tends to be greater incidents where you are flying out of a place where local and state leaders have said the pandemic is a hoax. What? Again, what local and state leader has said hoax?
Nobody.
All right. Here's a quick one for you. Sam, most annoying drink to order on a plane. Any guesses?
Ooh, most annoying drink. I would assume that it's something that would have to be mixed. I don't know what would be mixed, though, other than something alcoholic.
No, you would actually, you would be wrong. According to USA Today, a flight attendant. So, I don't know if it's a flight attendant. I'm speaking for all flight attendants. But reportedly revealed to Travel and Leisure, the most annoying thing anyone can order on a plane is Diet Coke.
Why Diet Coke?
Diet Coke is the most annoying thing you can order on a plane because, she says, whatever you decide to drink, right, don't order Diet Coke. They say that if you order Diet Coke on a plane, you're slowing everything down.
Why do they even offer it then?
According to the flight attendant, right, reportedly said, Diet Coke takes the longest of any other drinks to pour on board an airplane.
Weird.
And it's because on a plane, the high altitude heightens the foaming action of the carbonated drinks, according to what the flight attendant shared. Diet Coke is the worst because you have to wait for the fizz to, well, fizzle before you can continue pouring until finally the cup is filled. Yeah, but when I was on my flight, they just gave me the... They just gave me the can. They had one of those.
Oh, see, that's a good way to avoid.
They had one of those
issue.
Stupid little mini cans.
Yeah, see, and that seems like a sensible way to just expedite that process.
Yeah.
Instead of being a whiny flight attendant, maybe they should look for solutions.
We don't have time to get into this right now, but I did actually pull the worst flavor of soda you should ever drink. It's orange flavored soda.
Yeah.
They say that people think you're drinking something healthy and you're not.
It's weird, though, because, like, some kids love that, but I think it's gross.
Maybe, like, once a year, maybe. Gross. All right, Sam, what did you learn today?
At about 6:40 this morning, I learned that the Safe Air is officially returning this summer, although there are some details that are still pretty unclear. We had Andrew Langer on the show starting at 7 a.m. I learned his thoughts on several things, but especially Attorney General Merrick Garland declaring voting rights expansion central to democracy. And then Rob Dorr came on the show around 8 a.m. and I learned more about three young adults and gun groups that are suing over Minnesota's 21-year-old age requirement for gun carry permits. If you missed any of those conversations and want to catch up on the show, you can find our podcast on the iHeartRadio app by searching for Justice and Drew. What Sam Learned is brought to you by Advisory Partners. Learn more about how they can help a business at advisorypartners.com.
On tomorrow's show, is there a green revolution coming when it comes to your automobiles, or is it just something that the left is just dreaming of? We'll give you details on that. Plus, we are going to be talking at 6:55 with the former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and Drew will be back for Tuesday's show. Enjoy the rest of your day. The weather is going to be spectacular. Thank you so much for hanging out this morning, and be sure if you missed any portion of the show, as Drew said, to check out the podcast on the iHeartRadio app. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow morning. Bye. Get it myself. I don't want nobody give me nothing. Open up the door. I'll get it myself. Do you hear me?